To promote my new flower shop, I had one place print my business cards, another print my brochures, and a third, my signs. Now my roses aren't red, my violets aren't blue, my geraniums look dead, and I don't know what to do.
Staples can help your business stand out with signs, banners, and brochures that are a true reflection of your company. And now with Staples, spend $50 or more on print and marketing services and get $5 off your next in-store purchase.
Now my business is blossoming and I'm spending less green.
Exclusions apply. In-store only. End 6/23/18.
I've wanted to be a cowboy as long as I can remember. I love the animals. I love the land. I love the challenge that nature and economy, everything throws at you on a daily basis. Loving what you do, being able to make a living doing something you enjoy, that's my definition of success. I'm in it because it's in my blood.
Whatever drives you, wherever you are on your journey, whatever you're in it for, we're in it together. LinkedIn, you're closer than you think.
Buy a smartphone with GoPhone and get one free when you activate required lines of service and both devices on a qualifying rate plan with a $45 refill. AT&T, mobilizing your world. Offer ends May 31st, 2016. Valid on select phones at AT&T company-owned stores, which require new line of service on purchased phones, and participating authorized retail stores, which require new lines of service on both. Both phones require minimum $45 per month rate plan and $45 refill at time of sale in same transaction. Free phone must be equal or lesser value. See store for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. She can use.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. I posted the link to this show and the description on my Facebook page on how my guest, Michael Wheeler, finds that adaptation is the key to successful negotiations. Well, up pops this guy who follows me on Facebook and he thinks he'd get cute and he writes, LOL, Sun Tzu, just saying. My response? Oh, Sun Tzu, just saying. And my response was, indeed, Sun Tzu's words from The Art of War, the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. Now, hammering somebody to win is actually often counterproductive. Until now, it's been one of the two major approaches to negotiating, along with the win-win, relationships are everything approach. But my guest tonight, Harvard Business School professor Michael Wheeler, finds that these rigid, one-size-fits-all strategies often clash with real-world realities of negotiating. Drawing on his and his colleagues' research, he finds that the most successful negotiating techniques are born of an ability to adapt while negotiating and use agility, creativity, and wise preparation. Stick with us, and he'll tell you how to adapt to win in negotiation, the subject of his new book we'll be discussing tonight, The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. Hello, Michael.
Well, hello, Amy. Thank you for having me on.
I'm so glad you're here. I love your book. It is filled not only with wisdom, but great stories. And you open with the story of a guy, Jay Sheldon, who is trying to expand the cable television company he bought by buying another. And then, so midway through the negotiation, they're deadlocked. The seller wanted $3 million more than Sheldon was willing to pay. But before getting up to leave, he had this thought, what if the seller would be interested in buying his company? And he ended up selling it for twice what his firm paid. So you call Sheldon's agile thinking the mark of a master negotiator.
I think that that's right. And it's interesting, the person sitting across the desk from him, the owner of the property that he wanted to buy, didn't see the opportunity. And if Jay didn't see it, they would have said, well, there's nothing negotiable here. So it really takes an agile mind and an optimistic outlook to say, okay, if there's not one deal, maybe there's another. And he found it was even more profitable than the one he originally sought.
And you say that this is imperative in negotiations from start to finish, and that managing uncertainty should be the cornerstone of your negotiation strategy.
Well, I think it's beyond argument, frankly. The fact of the matter is, whoever is sitting across the bargaining table from us is likely to be as smart and as determined as we are, maybe as unpredictable as we are. we can't script their lines. We can't dictate what they're going to do or say any more than we let them pull our strings. So we've got to be adaptable.
And so before this, I mentioned my intro that there are these two distinct styles of negotiation. They're very different. And you know these people, Fisher, Urey, and Patton. They are the getting to yes on Cohen. Oh, no, so Fisher, Urey, and Patton, they're the getting to yes guys. And they talk about, you know, separating the people from the problem and options for mutual gain. And then there's Herb Cohen, the hardball style. So can you talk about how you feel about each of those, the merits and the problems?
Well, as different as they are, they have one thing in common, and that each in its own way thinks that's the way to negotiate in every case. And there are instances where, and I think the case we just talked about, where if you explore deeply into the interest, the way in which the getting to yes approach goes, looking at who values something more, you may well find a very good deal. But there are other deals where more for you is less for me, Amy, and that's more of the Herb Cohen haggling kind. But if you apply one of those approaches to everything you do, half the time you're going to be wrong. So I think you've got to be adaptable both to the situation you face and the person you're dealing with.
And now you talk about learning being so important to this. How do you define learning in terms of negotiating?
Well, let's think about it. Imagine that you've prepared as well as you can for a negotiation. Maybe you're looking, for example, for a new car, and you've read consumer reports, you've looked at all the other kinds of things. Maybe you've even taken a test drive. I hope you have some sense of what you value, how important it is to have the sunroof, how much more you'd pay for that, et cetera. But in the end, you'll have a hunch but not a firm idea about how eager the dealer is to sell that car. So what you're trying to do as you negotiate is get a sense, is there a little room for agreement or a lot? And I might add, the salesperson is doing the same thing with you while you are trying to gauge their willingness to sell. They're trying to gauge your willingness to buy.
You know, this great quote about learning, you say, learning can't be passive. It's not like reading a book. And that much of what you learn in negotiation can only come by interacting with the other party. We don't really think about that. You know, you think about practicing, you know, what you're going to say before a negotiation. So how do you learn while you're in a negotiation?
Well, one of the things, there's a wonderful saying that comes from the military, which is plans go out the window at first contact with the enemy. Eisenhower, the architect of D-Day, said plans are worthless. But what a lot of people forget is he said planning is everything. You have to have some sort of initial sense of direction, but you also need to be willing to let it go. Not to be kind of blinded by your expectations, but to have your eyes wide open to what's happening in real time.
Actually, you had this great line in this Dwight Eisenhower section that I even remember, which is amazing because I don't have a great memory, but it's, you talk about the difference between plans versus planning. Can you explain that?
Planning is the process of anticipating what you might be getting into. It's interesting. I mean, I got into, if I can backtrack just a little bit.
Sure.
I'm a lawyer by training. I've got a fair amount of economics behind me. I got into negotiation through game theory, decision analysis. So all of that stuff is you know, a set of tools for thinking rigorously. But the world is constantly in motion, so that as you make a plan, you're doing the best you can with what you know at this moment. But the notion that you ought to stick with your plan when circumstances change is just narrow-minded.
And all these people throughout the book, these great stories you tell, these people, by adapting in the moment, by realizing, okay, there's a different opportunity here, they are the ones who often win through negotiation. And you tell right at the beginning, can you tell the Citibank story? This guy, you know, he's just trying to appraise a church on a corner lot, and the result ended up being the Citibank Tower. How did that work?
Well, a lot of things happened between the beginning and the first chapter there and the last. What's interesting is it could have been a short story as opposed to a novel, and it was a novel. We're talking Midtown Manhattan. We're talking about the early 1970s, and a real estate firm was hired to appraise a church. The church, interestingly enough, was curious about what its value was. They thought maybe they could move to another site and and build more cheaply, have some money in the bank. But when the appraisal came in, it was for less than they hoped for.
And then what happened?
Well, then for some people they would have collected their appraisal fee and go home. But the fellow looked around the block and said, you know, these properties aren't worth much in their own right, but what if we pulled them all together? What would the sum of all these parts be worth? And the answer is a whole lot more than their individual value. Now, here's a guy who has that insight, has that idea, but he doesn't have the money, doesn't have a buyer. And what he did is recognize, okay, now across the street there's this sleepy bank. It was then called First City Bank of New York, I believe. I'm close on that. It may not be perfect. And their big rival, Chase, had moved downtown and built a spectacular building. So the real estate broker, the appraiser, had the notion of, well, these people might be interested, and indeed they were. So that was negotiation number two, if you will. They lined them up as a potential client. And then almost like a game of Monopoly, if you can visualize a map with all of the different properties around the block, they had to figure out whom to approach first, and they didn't want to do it in a very conspicuous way because they didn't want to invite competition. In some cases, they played hardball. In others, they were very creative, meeting the interests of the owners. And I think that they were adaptable in their mega strategy of assembling the whole block, but also in each transaction. They didn't use the one-size-fit-all approach, whether it be win-win or haggle time.
Now, something that you like from the win-win, or that's my perception, is something called BATNA, which is your best alternative to a negotiated agreement or your walk-away if there is no deal. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting. The word BATNA comes from, we have to tip our hat to the book, to Getting to Yes. It's an acronym, as you say, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. So if you're in a situation where, you know, you've done well and you've got a number of job opportunities and you're talking to a prospective employer, you know, your fallback, your walkaway may be very good. If you're fresh out of college, it's not so good, I suppose. But negotiation is always as compared to what? So you need to think hard about what's the least I'd be willing to accept before I'd say thanks, but no thanks. And that's your walkaway or your BATNA.
And so now you talk about doing a best-case and worst-case analysis before people negotiate, a pre-mortem, and you call this a powerful protection against wishful thinking. And this is, can you tell us about the pre-mortem, how that works and why it's good?
Well, I borrow that idea from two different sources. There's a wonderful guy, Gary Klein, who invented that term pre-mortem as opposed to post-mortem. But there's also a very similar kind of thinking that takes place in the Marine Corps. If you think about it, they have to be very fast acting under uncertain environments. And even when they only have a little bit of time, Amy, they try to do two things. One is they try to anticipate what's the most likely thing to happen, and then second, what's the most dangerous thing that could happen. And they have a contingency for both. Does that cover all the possibilities? No. But it covers the important ones. And I think in the same way you go into a negotiation, you ought to be thinking to yourself not exactly what's the most dangerous, but you know, what could weaken your bargaining position? Well, if you're going to buy something and a competing buyer shows up and you get into an auction of that sort, what are you going to do in that case? Or what under the circumstances could mean that you actually have more power than you anticipated? What would that look like? Maybe the seller is really desperate to sell. And you go in with a certain set of expectations, but if you've thought about best-case, worst-case scenario, you're going to be alert for signs that it's a little different from what you expected.
And one thing that you talk about, and it's throughout the book in a few places, is shifting the conversation away from hard dollars sometimes and focusing on fairness concerns. And we really, as humans, hate unfairness. And there's a great story in your book where, you know, people who feel screwed over, they drop the deal. And there's a guy, these elderly people you know, their tax bill ran up, and they wanted to move anyway, and they liked this guy, and he wanted to buy their beach house, and they said, okay, here's a price, and he had to get a guy to help him pay for it, and the guy wanted to really nail the people to the wall, raise the price, and then the deal fell apart. And so this is an example of where, you know, you talk about cautious optimism rather than this, okay, I'm just going to hammer you.
Well, it's interesting that even there, it wasn't necessarily hardball, but I changed the name of the person. He's a well-regarded professional, and he was kind enough to share the story with me. But we're talking about a lot of money. This was shopping for a beachfront property in a very luxurious part of the country. This elderly couple had owned the property for years and had never paid a nickel in taxes, as you mentioned. But then after 20 years, a tax bill came. It was for a large number. So they approached my friend and said, do you want to buy it? And they gave a price that he recognized was a bargain, but he couldn't afford it by himself. And he pulled a person who had a lot of money in reserve as a partner into it. But that guy said, well, we ought a counteroffer. My friend was reluctant to do it, but it wasn't his money he was playing with. And as a consequence, as you say, they started to haggle, and the owners said, forget about it. And the punchline is the owners put it on the market and sold it for five times what they were asking him. Whoops.
Whoops, yeah. You know, fairness, it just threw out your book. It's so important. This is Amy Alkins, Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Harvard Business School professor and researcher Michael Wheeler, and his book is The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. Now, you talk about it's particularly dicey to negotiate when there's something called a fixed pie attitude, when people believe there's only a given amount to be divided, and then they bring the long knives out.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, if you say this is only about dollars and cents, then it really, as I said before, more for you means less for me. It's a tug of war. It's hard to play that game with both people winning. I remember one thing that happens to you, Amy, if you hold yourself out as a person who knows about negotiation, you get all the family negotiations. And I was negotiating when we needed a new wagon when the kids were young for my wife's car, happy to do it. But when we showed up, we had an agreed price, and they had added some, you know, car prep, dock fee stuff on it that had not been discussed and wasn't in the document that I signed. And I said, sorry, I'm not paying it. And the manager said to me, looked me right in the eye, and he said, well, you know, if you don't pay it, it's going to come out of the salesman's pocket. I said, yes, and if I do pay it, it's going to come out of my pocket. The reality is there was another pocket there, which was the manager himself. There's no reason why he shouldn't have taken the hit in that instance. But I think they were using a pressure tactic, assuming that I feel sorry for the salesperson. We had a deal. We'd shaken hands on it. We'd not only done that, we'd signed an agreement, and they were trying to add some stuff to it. So I think on that, you genuinely can say no. In a different kind of situation, though, imagine that you were negotiating to buy a little summer cottage or something of that sort. That could be a straight cash deal, but if the seller was a family that owned it for a long time, you can't be there all summer. Maybe you work out a deal where you buy it, but you get it at a very good price, and they get to stay at their old place for a few weeks a year, and it isn't going to cost you anything, but it's something that they attach a lot of value to. So looking for something that's beyond a straight dollars and cents term can actually improve the deal for both parties.
Yeah, and this is what I love about your thinking, this adaptation. And a big part of that is thinking about the other people. What do they want? How do they feel? People think, you know, that being a good negotiator is this, okay, I'm going to nail them to the wall. I mean, you so often hear people saying that. And there are numerous examples in your book of people making these little personal gestures, maybe not even giving someone something. You write about these cancer researchers who wanted to buy a house. They'd never met the people who owned it, but they wrote a note to them saying how much it meant to them to move out of their condo and have a house of their own to fix up. And people are really motivated by those things often.
And I think often is the word, right? I mean, there are some people who are going to see the world in very narrow terms, and that's why I think you've got a flexible strategy. If the other side insists that all we're talking about are dollars, that may be the case. But if you see everything as a dollar deal and you don't understand the relational or the value-creating element of it, you're missing a lot of the picture. You're just looking at best, a two-dimensional picture when it's three-dimensional and in vivid color, and they're just seeing it in black and white.
And this relates to how you say you prefer the term baseline to bottom line. And I love this from you. You say the term bottom line rankles sophisticated negotiators, and with good reason, if it means a rigid position. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, let's, pick a number. I mean, obviously, there are some places where you still can buy a home that's in five figures. There are some where it's hard to find something in six. But let's say that you're on a budget where you figure you can pay $350,000 for a home in a nice neighborhood, but that's your maximum. You go shopping and you pay $375,000. Does that mean that you're a bad negotiator? Well, maybe, but it may be that you've discovered that the market is hotter than you anticipated, or it may be that the house that you looked at has wonderful energy efficiency, so you're paying more up front, but it's going to come back to you very, very soon in terms of the fact your utility bills are going to be lower. Or maybe there's great public transportation. Instead of two cars, you're going to get rid of one of them and use the bus or the train. So if you had a hard and fast bottom line, you'd be stuck to say no deal to a deal that, in fact, could be very good. Or the other way around, maybe the $350,000 that you were prepared to pay was too much when you see, I like the house, I like the yard, but gee, this needs a lot of repairs. So the $350,000, when you add what I have to put into it, that's not going to work. So it's a number that you start with, but you are constantly measuring to say, is this more or less attractive than I anticipated?
And you bring up a good point about the intangibles. Do I love this? And I had Elizabeth Dunn on my show. She's a BC researcher, as in British Columbia.
Let me interrupt you. I know Elizabeth. I met her some years ago. I hope she told you her shark story.
Oh, tell us her shark story.
She's an amazing person, and the punchline is she still surfs. She was surfing in Hawaii, away from some of the other surfers, in water that was very dirty, a lot of kelp in it. She felt something nudge her leg, and she thought it was kelp, and then it pulled at her leg. It was a tiger shark. And the thing that saved her life is that she was wearing a wetsuit, and essentially that acted like a compression bandage. I don't know if you've met her in person. She still walks fine and so forth, but she was in real danger at that point. She's a wonderful person, does great research, and is lucky to be alive.
Here I am on the east, and
we're talking about somebody who is on the Pacific coast of Canada, but she has a great reputation for her work, and I'm in awe of her courage.
Yeah, she is wonderful. And I was going to say, that when she was on my show, she talked about what her research finds, which is that buying experience makes people happier than buying things. And so a house can be something that you're buying, like the couple want to fix it up. They're buying experience. So that's a very important thing to do. Whereas if you're just buying, say, a diamond, maybe you need to do that to get the woman you want. But it's just you look at the value, and you talk about this, that's part of your baseline, that you have to look at these things, what's important to you, and the intangibles, how much are they worth?
That's right. I'll say one thing on that, and I told you in introducing myself, I've had a fair amount of economics, and I have a lot of friends who are in that field. But there's that old saying, the economists know the price of everything and the value of nothing. They'd leave the value things out of the equation. One of the challenges is, how do you value a relationship, right? It's one thing if we're negotiating with a car dealer who, as well prepared as we might be, knows more about the industry and knows more about the market than we can know. We've got friends who love us, family love us. We don't necessarily need to make a friendship there. The relationship value may be relatively low. Several years later, we sell the car to to some neighborhood kid, it's his or her first car, it's a very different kind of relationship, and we might well attach a value to that in a much greater degree than we would in the first case. Sure, that's subjective, but it also defines who we are in relationship to other people.
Yeah, and that's very important. And I see this throughout your book that people, they really are sensitive in these negotiations about how it plays out, whether they're being treated fairly. And I love this bit you had about there was a guy, a General Electric negotiator, who came in and just sort of laid down the bottom line on the table rather than negotiating. And you say it's really important to go into this tennis match with people of negotiating. It's not just here's our bottom line offer, that actually, he nearly got in legal trouble for that.
Oh, he did. He did. But it's interesting. I some of our listeners may have a visual way of thinking, others not. But if you can bear with me a little bit, just thinking about how you trade off the substance of the agreement, what you're getting, what you're giving, against the relationship side. I'll even tell you where I'm going to go with this so that people are not kind of strained to picture what I'm talking about. It turns out that those are independent of each other. So that if you had a graph with a vertical line, you know, the higher up you went, the better the deal, and then you've got a horizontal line that comes across it, the more over to the right you get, the better the relationship. Some people think, well, if I come down a little bit and accept a little less, if I make a concession, then I'm going to have a better relationship. It turns out that those two things are not correlated. They're not related. So you can come down in price, you can make that sacrifice in well-being, and you don't improve the relationship. People are concerned about feeling that they've been heard, that they've been respected, that they've been listened to, that they haven't been belittled. And it's utterly independent of the price that they pay or what they receive. So the worst of all possible worlds is that you compromise what you get substantively. You still don't have a good relationship. You're kind of in a lose-lose quadrant. It's possible if you negotiate in a forthright way, not always, but often, this is what I need, this is what I can do, this is what I can't do, here's how I think I can address your needs as you've described them to me, you can do very well in terms of the outcome and have the respect of the person with whom you deal.
We'll be back after this message from our sponsor.
Now's the time to get more happy because the SoCal resident ticket is back at the Disneyland Resort. Save up to 25% on select multi-day tickets, and with more savings, you get more excitement, more joy, and more magic. There's no better time to get more happy. Visit Disneyland.com/SoCal or click on the banner for details. Savings based on non-discounted price for the same ticket. Valid for residents in select SoCal zip codes with valid ID. Tickets expire May 24th, 2018. Restrictions apply.
And now, what's very interesting to me, since we're talking about agreements, it actually is possible, as you note, to be too agreeable, and not just in giving in, but you have this great quote you talk about, a CEO who told you very cheerfully, in 25 years, we've never failed to reach agreement. I guess this was with his middle managers, and you say this isn't a good thing, so tell us why.
Just so that people understand, he was in a meeting with actually fairly senior managers, but he stated this as a point of pride, and I didn't want to embarrass him in front of his colleagues. But privately, I said, that's an odd thing to be proud of, that you always come to agreement. I said, there are only two explanations that I can think of, and both of them are unsettling. One is that you're saying yes when you should say no. Just for the sake of agreement, you're saying yes even though you're losing money on the deal, or you're saying yes even though it sets a bad precedent. Or you're not being very daring. You know, there are certain deals that you must have. I understand that. But there ought to be some things where maybe you can't pull it off, but if you could, you'd have a great outcome. Your portfolio of negotiations ought to include some of those, because if you never reach high, you'll never be a high achiever, I suppose.
Now, Barry Schwartz, who's been on my show, has talked about satisficers and maximizers on my show, and satisficing, it's a strategy from Herbert Simon, the economist, of committing to the good enough choice instead of marching off on this never-ending search for perfect, and maximizers need everything to be the best ever. So what works best for negotiation, or does this change?
Well, it is interesting. You've named two names. You know, I know Barry and have great regard for his work. So we've got Barry, who's closer to my generation, and we were talking about Dunn before that. So it's a big country and so forth. But you've had some great guests, and I'm very pleased and honored to follow their footsteps. So Barry has done these tests, as you know, and some of your listeners who heard him know. He's got a book called The Paradox of Choice, which I strongly recommend. And there's a 13-question test in that. And it's the sort of thing of, there's some people, Amy, you go to the restaurant with, they take a quick look at the menu, they put it down, they know what they're going to have. There are others, everybody else has ordered, and the waiter or waitress is standing by, you know, I might do this, I might do that. They take forever to make a decision because they want to make the right one. Those are the maximizers. And they're just so aware of the fact that if they go with the steak, they're not getting the lobster. If they're getting the lobster, they're not getting the something else. Those are the maximizers. Now, this is Barry's research, but I do mention it in the book. He teaches at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, and he gave his undergraduate students that test. And people who are at one end of the spectrum, were the high maximizers, out of college were earning $20,000 more than the people who are at the other end, who were the satisficers, happy with what they got. And that was the point. The satisficers were getting paid $20,000 less, and they were happier than the maximizers. Now that's, you know, you could say kind of too bad for people at both ends of that spectrum, because if you're getting $20,000 less, it's harder to pay the rent. If you're getting $20,000 more unhappy, maybe that $20,000 is going to go to a therapist. I'm not sure. But the maximizer is somebody who really leaves no stone unturned, who thinks really hard about what the options are. That's all to the good. But what I would hope for myself is that I could have that attitude as I negotiate, and when I'm done, I'm done. And then I take my satisficer pill and just look forward.
I try to be wise about when to do each. And just a little story about me. Satisficing probably saved me from, I don't know, falling in the gutter as a drunk, because I used to spend all day on Saturday. My column is both funny and science-based, and I would spend the entire day Saturday making my first line as nuclear, radioactively funny as I possibly could. And then by the time I had to finish the rest of my column, I was exhausted, it was horrible, it was stressful. And so what I started to do, I came up with this line, the perfect is the enemy of the done, or the well done. And so I did a good enough job on Saturday. I didn't, you know, I wasn't a hack. I didn't say, oh, that's fine, I'll just go with that. But I stopped at a certain point and went on to the rest. And then at the end, I had the energy to come back and to punch up the line when I had distance from it. So it really, really worked. But in general, I'm a maximizer. I would have, I had a book deadline for my next book that's coming out in June, Good Manners for Nice People, who sometimes say, oh, I better get used to this, the F word. If I had not had a deadline, I would still be writing the book now. It's just crazy. So, I mean, it does take some restraint.
But two things from that, and we can go back centuries to the great British author Samuel Johnson. He said, there's nothing like the prospect of a hanging, Amy, to concentrate one's mind, right? So deadlines are important in negotiation as well. It's not an accident that cases settle on the courthouse steps or that strikes are averted at the, this is a cliche, but at the 11th hour. And that's because, you know, before you have to face that deadline, you're still wondering, well, you know, maybe the other side will buckle. If they're willing to offer me X right now, they'll pay me 2X when we're, you know, just about to send the case to the jury. But, of course, the other side is thinking the same thing, too. So what do they say? Work expands to fill time available. I guess writing does, you're telling me, and so does negotiation.
Yeah, That's very interesting. We're going to talk about mastering paradox when we come back. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Harvard Business School professor and researcher Michael Wheeler, and his very interesting book is The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. And I love his book, too, because it's filled with both research and it's not both, but research and wisdom and great stories. Now, you say that successful negotiation takes mastering paradox, and by that you mean balancing what seem to be opposing states of mind. And you give the examples being calm and alert, patient and proactive, and practical and creative. So how do you do that? How do you master paradox?
I think that that is hard and it is essential. If you go back to most of the books that have been written on negotiation, they've pushed emotion off to the side. Because the one emotion they think about is anger, and anger can get in the way, obviously, of good communication and of relationship building. But when we were talking earlier about things that people value, whether it's relationship or a certain degree of respect or just how much they love a particular house or car, or the case may be, that's all subjective. That's emotional, too. So it's important for negotiators to have empathy. Doesn't mean necessarily that they're weak, doesn't necessarily mean that they kind of give up advocating their own interests and so forth, but have some degree of appreciation of where the other side is coming from. It's interesting, you know, people like Daniel Goleman have been writing about emotional intelligence for 15 years or so. There's certainly a place for a book that would be called The Emotionally Intelligent Negotiator. I have in my chapter on presence of mind, I have some of that material. I don't think I've exhausted that topic at all.
Oh, no, I love that stuff. And actually, it's going to turn into a big researcher cocktail party, but you wrote about choking. And I had Sion Baylock on my show, and you talk about this, the empathy thing, that really listening to the other person in negotiation can help you avoid choking. And I think the mistaken thinking is that, oh, you're going all gooey, but it helps you not get caught up in thinking about yourself, which causes people to choke.
I think that's right. I mean, but that kind of loops us back to where we began the conversation. The reality, unavoidable reality, is you can't script negotiation. So you do not know, you can't know exactly what the other person is going to say or do. So you have to be nimble. You have to be agile. And recognizing that that's not unique to you, that everybody else can script it and you can't, that is just the way it is. Now, we're having this conversation, and it's taken, as far as I'm concerned, wonderful twists and turns. We didn't script it. You read the book very carefully, obviously. I've read it, too. but we're pulling in things that are from outside of that. And if you can approach negotiation with a view that it's an exploratory process, that by asking a question, by floating a this may be off the wall kind of proposal, you're testing not just how much room there is for agreement and what we might do to be creative, but how we can connect as individuals. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, we tried.
Yeah, it's something very important that you led to. I told you I have 9 pages of notes from your book here, and I'm really prepared. So being really prepared allows me, when you say one thing from the beginning of the book, I remember, oh, that great story about that couple at the end. And if I hadn't done that, I would be sort of lost, and it would be a lot less fluid. And I think both that kind of preparation, but you talk in this chapter, a great chapter, Presence of Mind, about emotional preparation. And I just want to read a few of these questions you ask because they're so good. You say that people to emotionally prepare should ask themselves, what do you want to feel going into the negotiation? Why? What can you do beforehand to put yourself in your ideal emotional state? What can throw you off balance? What do you do in the midst of negotiation to regain your balance? And very importantly, what do you want to feel when you're done? And these are great questions. I don't think people explore. They don't even think to explore the emotional side. All those questions are great questions.
Well, the book comes out of my research and my teaching, and I've learned an awful lot from my students over the years. The 6 questions that you just went through are questions that I use in class, and you can imagine a class discussion of them. Some of what you see in terms of the answers really grew out of what I heard my students say. And very often, the first thing that people say is, I want to be relaxed. Now, the mere fact that they tell you that tells you that they don't feel relaxed going into it, right? And that's something that they aspire to, but it doesn't necessarily come naturally. But then other people will say, and understandably so, I want to be relaxed, but not too relaxed. I don't want to be blissed out. I want to have a little edge. I want to be into it. Other people want to say, I want to be confident, but not foolhardy, right? And so that's what I mean about paradoxes. We need to be able to dial that all in. And part of what it takes to do that is taking the other stuff off the table. So let's say you have an ongoing negotiation. You're going back and forth. So many times we're doing that by email or by phone. Phone rings. Somebody wants to pick up this conversation with you. You could start right now. When you can, Amy, I would say, listen, I'm just wrapping up some things here. I'm going to call you back in 3 minutes. And what you want to do at that point is take some deep breaths, take those other things out of your mind, remember where you are in that negotiation, and then call the person back. And I am confident that you will be much better if you've just taken a little bit of time to focus than if you try to do it on the fly.
Now, this is something in my non-expert on negotiation advice that I give, that I've offered both to friends, myself, people who write me in my advice column, but to tell people they don't have to do things on another person's timetable. Because somebody wants something right now, they want an answer right now, that it's often good to not say, I won't give it to you, but to say, you know, I need a minute to think about that. And that's that kind of fluidity and creativity that you talk about. And in fact, you have this great analogy. You say that negotiating should be like jazz, because it's process of learning and adapting and influencing. It takes place moment to moment, you know, listening, responding, and that's like being a jazz musician.
Well, Ike, the shame on me. I've never had a music lesson in my life, and I'm actually intending to do it. I've learned so much from a colleague who teaches at Naval Postgraduate School, this is Frank Barrett, who's an organizational behavior guy, but also an accomplished jazz musician. He has introduced me to both the music and the brilliance that is behind it. I was just watching the other night, Amy, on HBO, a wonderful master class taught by Wynton Marsalis to three young, I think they were all in their teens, musicians, talented musicians. It wasn't just what note you played, but kind of what your state of mind is. And jazz people, he said, I love his quotations. He said, you know, if you jump off a building, and you're jumping off a building when you start to play, when you're improvising, if you jump off a building, you can't jump back, you know. You've either got to fly or grab something. And there is a point where you just commit yourself to go forward, and you'll find something you can play with. Jazz musicians have their little riffs that they get stuck. Negotiators can do the same thing, too. You know, because you lose your way. Amy, you know, I would say, let's kind of recap where we've gotten, what we have settled and what we have left to do. Or we've been down here in the weeds. I kind of worry that I'm losing track here where we ought to be going. Or even saying, you know, can we take a five-minute break here? It's just a way of regrouping yourself in the same way that jazz people will kind of go to a familiar little set they've got, and, oh, okay, now I can see where I go. And the jazz musicians also have, and it's a real skill, a capacity to be listening deeply where they're not thinking about what they're going to do. They're just taking it all in, and when it's their turn to solo, they'll know what to pick up on.
And you talk about a skill, anticipatory thinking, that we figure out what we could be facing, and that the more precisely you define your expectations, whether they're positive or negative, the more alert you're going to be for signs that confirm or contradict them.
Well, we'll go from another, you know, one venue to another. I talk about chess in the book. I talk about improv comedy and so forth, where obviously they have to be agile as well. But I come back to the military scene. There was a guy named John Boyd who was a maverick colonel in the Pentagon, And Maverick, in the sense that he was a colonel and people who were peers were being promoted to general, but he was such a pain in the neck that because he knew everything. He had studied, he'd been a flyer in the Korean War, and he studied encounters between F-86s and the Soviet MiG-15s. And he deduced a lot of important lessons, not just about aerial combat, but about military strategy, and I think negotiation as well. I want to make that point because just so people can see where I'm going. In those encounters between the F-86s and the MiG-15s, the American plane was inferior. It could not fly as high. It was not as heavily armed. It wasn't as fast. And yet it won 90% of the encounters. And there were two reasons for that. One, it had a bubble canopy, so the pilot had situational awareness. He, and they were all he at that point, could take into account everything around him. And they had, for the time, state-of-the-art hydraulic controls that allowed them to transition, pitch, climb, dip, all those sorts of things. So they could move much more rapidly. They could transition more rapidly than the Russian plane could. And those two things gave them terrific advantage. From that, I hope I'm not going on too long here.
Oh, no, this
from
is great.
That, he derived something that he called the OODA loop, O-O-D-A, observe, orient, decide, and act. And he said the hardest part in that cycle of observing, orienting, deciding, and acting is letting go of your expectations. You're looking for a mismatch. You're looking for, I thought I was going to be here, but now I'm someplace else, and you've got to discard it. And that's the wonderful thing that Sully Sullenberger did when, remember, we're back on the miraculous Hudson River landing a few years ago when the passenger jet was disabled with a bird strike. He was communicating with ground control. In the book, I've got a transcript of that, saying that his engines were out, and they were saying, well, we can clear a runway for you here at LaGuardia. He said, no, not possible. Then he asked about Teterboro over in New Jersey, and by the time they get back, and that's not possible either. When it was clear he was losing altitude at such a rate, he was not going to make it back to the airport, he said, we're going to the Hudson. And he didn't want to go on the Hudson. He would have preferred Teterboro. He would rather that he was back in LaGuardia. But he just struck those from the agenda because they were not going to work. And we need to do that in negotiation and lots of other arenas, too, that, go back to Wynton Marsalis. We've jumped off the building. We're not going to jump back on again.
Yeah, and that's such a great example with Sully because here he was expert, but also he was able to anticipate. And you acknowledge that it's scary to act in the face of uncertainty. You don't have all the facts, but you say that this OODA, observing, orienting, deciding, and acting, that observing and orienting yourself, set up, deciding, and acting, that you have to have that. That's where it's so important to get out of the mode of choking where you, like you said, you observe the other person. You're trying to feel what they're feeling, hear what they're saying, because then you're not focused on yourself, and you can do that orienting yourself and then deciding what you're going to do from it rather than just thinking, what am I going to say next, which isn't engaging with the person and probably fails because of it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You've mentioned Barry Schwartz, Elizabeth Dunn, and so forth, and my own research as well on emotion. But one thing we haven't talked about is I've had the great good luck to meet, maybe the world's greatest negotiators. There's something physically based at Harvard Law School, but it's Harvard, it's MIT, it's Tufts, some other Boston area schools, called the Program of Negotiation. And we give a prize to great negotiators from different contexts. Most recent was Jim Baker, who had been the first George Bush's Secretary of State. First one, this was a dozen years ago, was George Mitchell for bringing peace to Northern Ireland. There's a lesser-known person, Lakhdar Brahimi, an Algerian UN official troubleshooter who, there are others maybe as impressive, but nobody more so. And when students asked him what they needed to have to be great negotiators, he said, this is going to sound contradictory, but you have to be arrogant and humble. And he said, that's not a contradiction. He said, you have to be arrogant in the sense that you have to believe that you can see agreement where other people say it's utterly impossible, and particularly for the work that he does, where he just goes into the worst places in the world. So you've got to have that kind of view that there's a solution here and I'm going to find it. But he said, you also have to be humble that no matter how well prepared you are, no matter how many negotiations you've had, you only know part of the story. And there's bound to be something out there that you didn't anticipate, you didn't expect, that you've got to reorient, to go back to the OODA loop, you've got to reorient yourself. Whereas if you think you know it all, you're just setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, that is so important. And you really lay out these stories that tell this so well, and you've been doing some of them. There is another one that I really liked that actually illustrates the fluidity. This guy is not a humble guy, but that works so well that if you can be fluid when you're negotiating, it can make a situation that seems irreversible not irreversible. And tell the story about the comic who was working on Saturday Night Live and told off his boss.
Yes. Well, this is a writer, you know, at the heyday of Saturday Night Live, a job, you know, that was the ideal job for so many striving comedians, and only a few people had it. Well, this guy, you know, we'll call him David, had his sketches cut, you know, night after night, and one of them even after rehearsal. So he stormed into Ebersol's, this is the producer's control room. It's Saturday Night Live. It is a live show. And just threw a tantrum saying that he was underappreciated, they had no taste, and he quit, right? Just quit in front of everybody. Now, he's quit the dream job. He walks home. By the time he gets home, he realizes he's made a horrible mistake. As his next-door neighbor, you know, he's talking to his moaning, what have I done? His next-door neighbor says, I have some advice. Pretend it never happened. So on Monday, after Saturday Night Live, when they're having their writers' meeting for the following week's show, David walks into this meeting, sits down, as if nothing had happened. The other writers look at him in amazement. They don't say anything. Then Ebersol, the producer, walks in, looks at him. He doesn't say anything either. And the David I'm speaking of is Larry David. It's a true story, and he actually used it in one of his Seinfeld. Remember, he was one of the creators of Seinfeld, and one of the Seinfeld stories. So that's also like the jazz musician thing. Somebody plays a bad note. You can't say, I want a time capsule. I want to go back and have you play the right note there, please. You've got to take the what's been dealt you, whether it is that you put your foot in your mouth or whether somebody else in your quartet has played the wrong note. Those are the cards that have been dealt. You got to play them.
Now, it helps to realize, too, that people are fallible. This is something Albert Ellis, who's the late founder of cognitive therapy, advised, that people were all fallible. And if you realize that, you accept that about yourself, it's easier, I think, emotionally to deal with your errors and say, okay, well, I'll just show up and see if I can maybe just, they'll just go with it. And this inventiveness, it's throughout your book, and you talk about this as a way to overcome barriers. And I love this story, especially as an author, about this author who signed a contract for a biography of FDR. His book, he did all this research, turned out to be 1,400 pages long. And nobody buys 1,400-page books, and they wanted major cuts, and he said no and gave back the advance. But then he contacted another publisher, and tell us what happened.
He brings the same manuscript, the same unpublishable manuscript, to another house. It's W.W. Norton. They look at it and say, this isn't a book, it's two books. And it was Joseph Lash, and the first book was Franklin and Eleanor. It won the National Book Award, was a Pulitzer Prize winner. It is still in print, what is it, 30 years later. The second half became Eleanor, The Years Alone, and that was also a very successful book and is still in print. Now, what's interesting, to go back to the orienting thing, Amy, the first publisher had a contract that says you're going to deliver this book, you know, and they have a view of what a book is, and it's hard for them to get out of that frame. The second publisher looks at it as an opportunity and sees it's not one book, it's two. It's like for those of the listeners who've been on for the whole program, the first story we told about my friend Jay Sheldon, there's got a $3 million gap in a deal. The most he's willing to pay is $3 million less than the seller will accept. They turn the deal upside down. He becomes a seller. The other guy becomes a buyer. So having that mental agility to say, okay, wait a second, there's another deal here. Not always, but often. But if you assume there isn't, then you're going to be right.
Well, I think that knowing this is what I learned from your book, and I should say the book, name of your book, it is The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. The author is Harvard Business School professor and researcher Michael Wheeler, who has been with us for this hour, and I wish it could go on for 2 hours.
We'll be right back. Now's the time to get more happy, because the SoCal resident ticket is back at the Disneyland Resort. Save up to 25% on select multi-day tickets, and with more savings, you get more excitement, more joy, and more magic. There's no better time to get more happy. Visit Disneyland.com/SoCal or click on the banner for details. Savings based on non-discounted price for the same ticket. Valid for residents in select SoCal zip codes with valid ID. Tickets expire May 24th, 2018. Restrictions apply.
So this creativity, a part of it is just hearing, oh, wow, people do that, I think. But also you talk about this, the gap between knowing and doing, which Yale parenting expert Alan Kasdan was on and spoke a lot about. And you say that familiarity with negotiation, with the concept of negotiating, doesn't guarantee that people will put it into practical use. So what helps people ingrain what they've learned?
Well, I think it's a willingness to push forward. I talk in the book about a bias for action, and I mentioned seeing that Wynton Marsalis show recently. I've heard him speak. And during that show, he said you have to go there to get there. And so I think that there's a proactivity that's necessary, along with a very open outlook, that you're as well prepared as you could be, but your preparation is going to help you identify, if you will, a more finer-grained view of the landscape that you're traversing. I go back to the Ambassador Brahimi from the UN. You navigate by sight. He says your eyes are the only tool you've got. So I think it requires some curiosity. You were talking earlier in writing of the perfect being the enemy of getting it done. the notion that we're going to negotiate perfectly actually I think is debilitating. We want to do it well. We have to understand that the other people we're dealing with are operating the same constraints, same limited knowledge, same fluid environment. If we're concerned with doing better with them, we just have to be a little more observant, a little more flexible.
And now you warn people about our human biases and foibles, how we will often attribute things, successes to ourselves that we don't deserve, that maybe we're just luck. And you talk about two questions your researcher colleagues like to use to learn from a negotiation are WWW and WWYDD. What went well, and what would you do differently after you finish a negotiation? Those seem really wise questions.
Well, it's one of those things where I think people are getting better at preparing for negotiation. Obviously, that's something where it's time well spent. But over time, we can build our own library of experience if, after we negotiate, we ask those questions. What worked well? What did I anticipate? What was I prepared for? And what would I do differently if you could kind of replay the tape? What would you do differently? Okay, you can't rewind the tape, but maybe you've learned something you can apply next time around. I think it's even better if, when you start out, and I'm not talking about getting very formal, but if you wrote yourself a little note, here's what I'm thinking we're getting into, here's my best-case scenario, here's my worst-case, here are my priorities, here I trade them off, see how those look in hindsight. And what you're trying to do is sharpen your ability to anticipate, and you can do that, I think, by calibrating on how well you've done that in the past.
Now, we're almost out of time. I want to end on fairness because your book is so good on this, and it's unexpected perhaps for people because they think of negotiation, again, as nail them to the wall. You asked some really good moral questions in your last chapter, and one of them, can you talk about the lady selling the old lady selling a cabin and asking only $180,000 or $80,000 when it's worth much more? I can't remember if it was $80,000 or $180,000, but you say it's worth much more, and you ask people, what will they do? Quickly accept the asking number, counteroffer with a somewhat lower figure, know that you can always agree to that $180,000 if necessary, or inform her that you want to buy the cabin, but you believe she's overvalued it. So what do you tell people who want to stick it to the old lady?
So here's what I say. Let's back up and deal with the larger issue. I think every time you negotiate, you implicitly face some very basic questions. One, and this is the scenario you just gave, how much do you owe, if anything, the other party in terms of fairness of the outcome? Two, what do you owe, if anything, in terms of candor, in terms of being honest? And three, what do you owe, if anything, in terms of the use or not using hard tactics? And there are, in fact, different answers, different morally justifiable answers that you can come up with. You can read the philosophers and so forth. But what you don't want to do is to come up with the answer after you've taken action. It's very easy for us to create a rationalization for actions after the fact. I think we're defining ourselves and defining our values every time we negotiate, because essentially we're engaged in a transaction with another human being, and in some instances it's perfectly okay to look out for ourselves. You know, what's that old saying from Hillel? If we're not for ourselves, who will be? But sometimes people forget the other part of it, which is if we're only for ourselves, who are we? So I think people really need to think through those moral choices in advance so they're not making hasty judgments that they either feel guilty about or they have to apologize for.
Well, thanks. Oh, this has been such a great show. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight has been Harvard Business School professor and researcher Michael Wheeler. His book, which is terrific, as you can hear from the show, is The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. Michael, thank you. That was such an interesting show. I just loved having you on.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Hey, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda dealer. You might know us from our random acts of helpfulness. Recently, we gave a veteran a brand new 50cc scooter to help him get to his appointments at the VA hospital. And we can help you get around, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2016 Accord LX, a 2016 IIHS top safety pick with a built-in rear-view camera. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you, and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know.
Getting lost in the music is great, except if you're driving. Nissan's available Intelligent Safety Shield technologies could help you avoid bad drivers. Hurry into your local Nissan store and get great offers during the Safety Today event, or shop ChooseNissan.com today. Now, back to the music.
I'm Colleen Schneider, and I'm a mixed martial arts fighter. I actually consider myself a pacifist. I've never been in a fight in my life outside of martial arts. But that's the only way you grow and develop as a person, if you choose to do things that push you and challenge you and make you uncomfortable. MMA is not the smartest career choice. It's something you do out of passion and love.
Whatever drives you, wherever you are on your journey, whatever you're in it for, we're in it together. LinkedIn, you're closer than you think.
Hi, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda person, and recently we've been doing random acts of helpfulness, like donating shoes to children in need and helping a music therapy facility with new instruments. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on an award-winning Honda, like the all-new and completely redesigned Accord, a Car and Driver 10 Best a record 32 times. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know. Car and Driver, January 2018.
You got a friend in me.
You got a friend in me. celebrate friendship and beyond during the first ever Pixar Fest with the all-new Pixar-themed fireworks spectacular and your favorite park parades. Celebrate from April 13th through September 3rd, only at Disneyland Resort. Visit Disneyland.com for details.
There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you.
You've got a friend.